All right. Good morning, everyone, and welcome. To those who are joining us on C-SPAN, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Dr. Timothy J. Orr. I'm a professor of history here at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia, and you are joining History 351, the history of the Civil War and Reconstruction. We've been going all semester talking about all things related to the coming of the Civil War, the way it was fought, and we'll be finishing up in a few weeks with how it ended and its legacy. And so today we're going to be talking about a rather depressing subject, but nevertheless an important one, the story of the prisoners of war. And I'd like to begin by kind of offering kind of a two expressions in Latin, jus in bello and jus ad bellum. Does anyone here know what they mean? Yeah, it's kind of a tough language to decipher. But jus in bello means justice in war, and jus ad bellum means justice of war. And if you try to consider the philosophies of just war theory, there are two things you want to examine. Is the war fought for quote-unquote just purposes, and is it fought with quote-unquote just methods? And you can examine any American conflict this way. You can sort of mix and match the two ideas. You can fight a just war with unjust methods, and you can fight an unjust war with just methods. In the case of the American Civil War, we certainly don't need to consider the question of the justice of war, because both sides believed that they were fighting for a just cause. But the question we're looking at today is that first one, jus in bello, justice in war. Did this war show justice in terms of the way both sides treated each other's prisoners? And I would say both sides had the advantage of having of understanding the conventions of war, the respectability, the respect that needed to be shown both sides, because prior to the war, they were all one and the same nation with the same matched history, many of them with the same religion, many of them with the same sort of social conventions and ideas about how conflict should proceed. But during the course of the war, we're going to see that questions will arise about the ethical treatment of prisoners, questions that will defy the conventions that both sides had prior to going into the war. So as we examine this question, we can think about it in terms of just war theory. Was justice committed to these prisoners? And in what ways should justice have been upheld? Now, to understand the prisoner of war system, it's very simple because it proceeds in three phases. And if you understand these three phases and when they come about, you can easily understand how the Civil War proceeds. There is the first phase called the parole and exchange phase, the second phase known as the cartel phase, and the last phase, the prisoner of war camp phase. And these weren't phases that were described by the people at the time, but phases that historians have delineated since then. Now, at the beginning of the war, one of the things that politicians and generals did not anticipate were large numbers of prisoners. Many thought the war would be over in a short period of time, and it would involve very little hardship and little lingering animosity. And whether the nation remained as one or whether it would be split in two during the course of the conflict, neither side initially believed that abusing the other's prisoners would gain them any long-term goals. This is a good example of it. This is a photograph taken after the first major land battle of the Civil War, the Battle of Bull Run, in July of 1861. These are Union prisoners of war. They have been taken to a camp outside of Charleston, South Carolina, and they're awaiting their parole and exchange. That is, after they have been taken prisoner, they're going to go home. And so surrendering in the Civil War is a fairly easy process. Although there are widespread accusations on both sides that people are committing atrocities and executing surrendered prisoners, early in the war that simply does not happen. The prisoners' rights are respected, and they are sent and taken to a prisoner of war camp, taken care of, and then after a short period of time, they are sent back to their army, back into circulation so they can fight again. And this is kind of a marvelous image here, because what do you see but none other than shelves of liquor? So these Union soldiers have a very easy life, and essentially surrendering early on in the Civil War is like being out in a game of tag. You're only out temporarily, and you can go back to rejoin your unit once you have been formally exchanged. So how does this first phase, this parole and exchange system, work? Well, it works under the idea that once a prisoner surrenders, he must sign a formal parole. And that is, he will vow not to take up arms against the other nation until he has been properly exchanged. And this is an example of a parole of honor of a Union soldier from Michigan. And it's printed on kind of Confederate letterhead here. And you can just issue these out to the prisoners that you've taken in battle. It says when he signs the parole, makes his mark, and it vows that on his honor, he will not bear arms against the Confederate States or perform any military or garrison duty whatever until regularly exchanged. And further, he will not divulge anything relative to the position or condition of any of the forces of the Confederate States. So while he's in Confederate captivity, and if he returns to the Union on parole, he cannot tell his superiors what he has seen or what he has done. So how does this system work? How do you get parolees to hold to this promise? What is the foundation of it, do you think? Nicole? Honor. And that's the number one answer. You know, here at Old Dominion, we have sort of an honor code that sort of, where you all regulate the academic integrity of the institution by yourselves. It's the same thing for prisoners of war early in the Civil War. They have to regulate this system of those who surrender. They have to hold to this parole, hold to this promise that they are not going to divulge any information. And some of these individuals take it very seriously. One example I can give you comes from September of 1862. A Union colonel named Moore is taken by the Confederates. He is paroled very quickly because it occurs during the Maryland campaign. And Moore is given his parole, and he's sent off of this huge acclivity called South Mountain. And as he's walking down the National Pike, he bumps into the Union Army that is pursuing the Confederate Army. And we've discussed the Maryland campaign and the sense of urgency the Army of the Potomac had. Now, all of a sudden, they have a Union prisoner who is only a few hours removed from being in Confederate captivity. And they were begging Moore to divulge some information. They said, Colonel Moore, good to see you. Where are the Confederates? And this is why I can't tell you that. Well, we're headed up this road a ways, up over the South Mountain. And Moore goes, you are? My goodness, be careful. And the general who questioned him said, oh, what do you mean by that? Where are the Confederates? And he says, well, I've said too much. And so they were begging Moore to give up some information, but he would not. So this system of honor was extremely important, and it was the thread that held together this first phase of how prisoners were treated. Now, another aspect of the parole is what happens once you sign it. Now, if you signed a parole, as a prisoner of war, you were allowed to go home, to sit, continue to receive army pay until you were properly exchanged. And the exchange was done by the respective governments. There would be agents in charge of prisoners of war who would negotiate for your release. And these exchanges ran on rates based on the rank that you held. So if you were a private soldier in the Union Army, you had to be exchanged for a private soldier in the Confederate Army. And then once that exchange was made legal, you would receive notification to report to your unit within a period of time, or else you would be found AWOL. And there was an elaborate system that both sides had to agree to make these exchanges. So if you wanted to exchange a captain, you had to have six privates on the other side to make that exchange, or any sort of permutation. Generals ran in the vicinity of about 40 privates, colonels 15, lieutenant colonels 10, majors 8, captains 6, and then on down to one non-commissioned officer equal to two privates. And of course, making all this work, because each side has a different number of prisoners in their possession early in the war, makes it difficult. So if you were captured in battle and you signed one of these paroles, probably you could expect to sit on your bottom for a long period of time until the government actually got around to exchanging you, because the negotiations could run for weeks, even months. So we discussed the things that this system ran upon, that it relied upon a mutual agreement on both parties that this system was in existence, and the other thing, it relied on the honor of parolees. Now, certainly abuses and problems occurred, And what kind of abuses and problems do you think pervaded this system early on?
Just the fact that maybe people didn't honor the parole, just went out and went back to fight.
Right. Because one of the things about this system is there's no police agency to enforce the parole system. So anyone could easily just simply go back and fight. And which of the two sides do you think violated this parole system more often? Paul.
Confederacy?
You say the Confederacy. Why?
Well, because they had a lot of that, their Southern pride and their heritage, and they wanted to fight this war. They wanted to become independent. So I'm guessing their motivation would be like, okay, we're free now, so let's get back to the fight.
Okay. And it's kind of interesting that you talk about sort of like Southern pride and things, because when we think of like the stereotypical Old South, we think of Southern honor. And if you're suggesting that the Confederates are the first to violate this parole of honor, it kind of flips our image of the Confederacy on its head, does it not? All right, what are some other reasons the Confederacy would be the first to try to violate these paroles?
They thought they had less fighting men, perhaps. Mm-hmm. They felt that they needed the intelligence in order to be more on par with the Union amount of men.
Right. So one of the issues is, of course, the numbers of men. And the Confederacy cannot afford to keep, you know, willing men on the home front sitting and waiting out their paroles before they go back into service. Any other reasons? Let's also sort of think about the situation the South has to face. You know, let's say Katie, for instance, is part of Stonewall Jackson's army in 1862. She's captured at the Battle of Kernstown in March, and then she signs a parole, goes back home to Winchester. 2 months later, what happens? But the Union Army marches into that city. Now, she is a paroled prisoner of war, and she is basically obligated to kind of stay out of the action. But yet there are Union soldiers in her hometown milling about. How do you think they treat her?
Badly.
Not well, right? I mean, these Union soldiers should treat this prisoner with respect, but they know what she's going to do. That when she's finally exchanged, she's going to go back and join Stonewall Jackson's army. So is she just going to sit there and endure these Union prisoners, these Union soldiers jeering at her, probably stealing all of her personal possessions and her chickens and cows and what have you? No, she's not going to sit there and take it. She's going to be probably eagerly awaiting the opportunity to rejoin her army, and she'll do it. And since the Union Army can do nothing to check to see if she's adhering to her parole, she'll do it. So think about this. If she violates her parole and she's captured a few weeks later at one of the other battles in the Shenandoah Valley, and a Union soldier captures her, what's she going to do when she surrenders?
Sign another honor code.
Okay, you'll sign another one, exactly. But are you going to sign the same name?
No.
No, you'll just make something up. I mean, and does that Union soldier have any way of checking your identity? Right. And you think about this. This is the 19th century. We have no driver's license. We have no internet. We have no social security, no soldier's ID number, no way to check a person's identity. And consider, for the sake of argument, that, you know, this Union soldier is concerned, suspects that Katie might be a parole violator. Does he have this big list in his pocket of people who are on parole from the Confederacy? No way the Union Army can disseminate that information. So quite frankly, she's free to do whatever she wants. And the only possibility that she might have is the rare instance that she's captured twice by the exact same captor, right? And I mean, what are the chances of that?
How would they know if they got exchanged or not, though?
The prisoner?
Yeah.
Well, you'd be informed by your government that they would send you a notice.
Okay.
And then they'd say, you were exchanged, you have such and such a time to report back to your unit.
Right. I didn't know. I'm not talking about the officer that captured me again. If I got captured by the same officer, how would he know if I was exchanged or not?
Right. They wouldn't. They wouldn't at all.
So I could fight that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So the point is, there are many holes in this operation. And by the second year of the war, they are already starting to shred. Both Union and Confederate soldiers violate it, but the Confederates, for more practical reasons, violate it more often. And this leads to the second phase of the prisoner of war system, known as the cartel phase. And negotiations begin in the early part of 1862, when generals from both sides argue that something needs to be done to rectify this situation. And it happens right after the first large-scale surrender of an army, and that is when the Confederate Army surrenders at Fort Donelson in February. And by July 1862, after the failed Peninsula Campaign, the system goes into effect. And it will last for about a year. And it's known as the Dix Hill Cartel, because it's named for the two generals who created it, Union General John Dix and Confederate General D.H. Hill. And what this system does is it modifies the parole system, that now soldiers themselves are not allowed to sign paroles. Only the two generals or any of their respective agents can sign paroles and conduct the exchanges. So what this means is that if you surrender as a soldier, whether you're in the Union or the Confederacy, you will be taken to a prisoner of war camp, held there for a few weeks, and then you'll be sent to an exchange location. In the Eastern Theater here in Virginia, it was at Aiken's Landing on the James River, and in the Western Theater, it was at Vicksburg on the Mississippi River. And there, the physical exchange of prisoners would take place, but the official exchange would take place later when the two cartels had negotiated the release. So where do these Union and Confederate prisoners go until they are formally exchanged? Well, they will go to what are called parole camps. This is an image of the largest parole camp in the Eastern Theater, known as Camp Parole in Annapolis, Maryland. So this is a prison camp for Union soldiers, but their guards are their own men. They are guarded by Union sentries. And so it was essentially each side's responsibility to ensure that their own men would not violate their paroles. And the Confederacy had several parole camps as well. If any of you are from the Annapolis region and you've driven through it, there's a neighborhood there called Parole. It is named after this particular camp. Now, once again, these parole camps had some problems. They're not fun places. The Union soldiers disliked the fact that they would be treated as prisoners within their own state. They were guarded by their own men. They were often guarded by what were known as the invalid corps, wounded soldiers who were on light duty. And those parolees could not leave. They could ask permission to go into the city and visit Annapolis, but passports were issued at a limited rate. They were fed, they were not abused, and they had some freedoms until they were formally exchanged, but this freedom was limited. Now, imagine again this position. You're a Union soldier, and you've been taken to Camp Parole. How are you feeling about this? You want out, and do you think the guards are going to let you out? They might. Under what conditions might they let you out?
Bribery,
right? Because these aren't Confederate guards we're talking about. These are your own men. What are some other conditions you could use to get out of prison? Paul or Josh?
If there's like a big battle or something, they don't have enough soldiers to fight maybe, or they need extra, the general could say, send them maybe.
Exactly. This phase occurs during one of the darkest times for the Union Army, when in 1863, consider you're a Union prisoner and you've been taken at Chancellorsville. You're sent to Annapolis, and then all of a sudden you learn that the Confederate Army is invading Pennsylvania. Things look really dire. And you can go to the guard and say, hey, I want to rejoin my unit. Let me out of here. Is that guard going to say no? If he's sympathetic to the Union cause, he's probably not. And he's just going to turn his back and let you slip out. So the guards themselves violate this second phase, the cartel phase. Generals as well also violate it. One of the biggest abusers of the cartel system was Robert E. Lee. Lee hated taking care of Union prisoners. This was especially clear during the Gettysburg campaign. When his army invaded Pennsylvania, he was defeated, and then he had to retreat back to Virginia with nearly 5,000 prisoners. And what did Lee think of these 5,000 prisoners? Did he want them as part of his army? Not if he is trying to get back to Virginia. They are a detriment to his campaign. And immediately after he takes them prisoner, on July 6, 1863, he offers them the opportunity to sign a parole. And if you're a Union prisoner, you're in Lee's possession, you have one of two options. You can keep to your official duty, march 200 miles back to Virginia, go into a prisoner of war camp and wait to be physically handed back to your authorities, or you can immediately sign this parole, go back and rejoin your friends who are coming to get you, who are probably only a few miles away, but you, of course, violate your obligation as a Union soldier. Which of those two are you going to do?
Go back to the Army.
You would like to go back to the Army, right? So you'd like to just rejoin your comrades. Would some of them have qualms about this?
Honor.
Yeah. If honor is important to you, you're going to tell Lee that he's got to go away and he has to honor this system that's in place. And the troublesome thing for these Union soldiers was that there was a Union general who was captured along with them. And they were debating among themselves whether they should sign the parole, because a lot of them wanted to go back home immediately. But the general, named General Graham, said, "You can't do that, men. You are Union soldiers, and you are obligated not to accept a parole under this system." And it essentially created a riot among the Union prisoners while Lee is trying to take them back down to Virginia, because they didn't know which of those decisions they should adhere to. And it was easy for the general, General Graham, because he's a general, he's going to be exchanged right quick. But if you were a private, you could expect, of course, to be in Confederate captivity for some time. Now, another important issue involving the cartel phase was the question of African-American prisoners, because they would never be exchanged under Confederate opinion. In late 1862, Southern commanders vowed to return all black prisoners taken in battle to a state of slavery, whether they had been free before the Civil War or not. And Confederate generals even vowed to execute white officers who commanded United States colored troop regiments under criminal law. And many Southern states had laws in it that said that leading a slave rebellion was punishable by death. And to them, being a commander, a white commander in a black regiment, was akin to leading a slave rebellion. So under state law, they could be executed. In May of 1863, the Confederate Congress upheld this popular opinion by passing a joint resolution calling for the execution of white officers and the immediate enslavement of black soldiers. Now, the U.S. War Department, when it heard this announcement, decided what it would do was issue an order of retaliation. That is, it would execute captured Confederate officers, one for each white U.S. colored troop officer executed, and enslave one white Confederate prisoner, one for each black USCT soldier thus enslaved. And in July of 1863, it was the first test case of whether the U.S. government would uphold this promise. That month in North Carolina, a captured USCT soldier was executed by Confederate authorities, and a regimental commander, the commander of the soldier who was executed, decided he was going to put to death one Confederate soldier, which he did. And after the execution of this Confederate soldier, Jefferson Davis called off the execution order issued by the Confederate Congress. And he urged local Confederate commanders not to execute or enslave USCT soldiers. So there was the hint that there might be an eye for an eye warfare because of the capture of black soldiers. But although it looked like there would be, both sides showed restraint. Now, these problems eventually bring the Dix Hill Cartel to an end. And the final nail in the coffin is in April 1864, when a Confederate force under General Nathaniel Bedford Forrest, pictured here, surrounded a Union garrison at Fort Pillow, Tennessee, on the Mississippi River. And when the garrison tried to surrender, his soldiers broke into a frenzy, killing those who threw up their arms, because the garrison was a mix of white and black soldiers. And it's not exactly clear how many soldiers at this garrison were killed when they tried to surrender, but a massacre definitely occurred. And about 170 African-American soldiers, it is believed, were killed in the act of surrendering. So when this news reached the War Department later on that month, General Ulysses Grant, who is now the General-in-Chief of all Union forces, remember this is right before he will embark on his overland campaign, makes the decision to suspend the prisoner exchange system. He says, listen, if the Confederates are not going to accept the surrender of black troops, we need to hold their prisoners of war indefinitely. Not only does it keep these Confederate prisoners from going back into circulation, but it ensures the protection of our own black soldiers who are taken in battle. And The results of this were immediate, because now Union soldiers understood that if you were caught in battle, you would be held permanently. So it was no easy process of getting back to your own army, which meant that if you're a Union soldier and you did not want to spend time in a prisoner of war camp, it might be better to run from the enemy than to fight and perhaps face captivity. And one of the reasons we were kind of talking about for the struggle the Union Army had during the Overland Campaign, and I made the argument that by the end of it, these armies were kind of in a really poor shape. One of the things the Union soldiers were understanding is that if they surrendered, they would actually go to Andersonville, which is something they did not want to do. So it was probably better in their best interest, if they wanted to survive, to run if the battle did not look like it was going their way. Now, for African-American soldiers, the Fort Pillow massacre gives them a justifiable reason to retaliate. And when African-American troops go into battle, oftentimes they go in under this desire not to take Confederate prisoners for retaliation of what had been done to their race back in April 1864. So many African-American regiments had this cry, "Remember Fort Pillow." And here is a regiment that is designed as battle flag based on vengeance. It was as a black soldier bayoneting a Confederate. And this is the emblem this regiment took into battle. And again, try to think about this in 21st century terms. No American unit can have sort of a vengeful insignia like this today. But back in the 19th century, this is very common. All right, so this brings us to the third and final phase of the prison system, and that is the prisoner of war camp phase. And this will begin in August of 1863 and last until the end of the war. Now, they have prisoner of war camps before then, but they're, again, supposed to be temporary holding pens for prisoners before they are exchanged. But the most of the war, if this phase is in operation and it's holding hundreds of thousands of prisoners on both sides, and they have to deal with the problems of being in such a system. And we're going to kind of go through several prisoner of war camps on both sides and give you a flavor for the problems that existed in each. And this is an image of Point Lookout, Maryland, one of the first of the prisoner of war camps designed to house Confederates right after the breakdown of the Dix Hill Cartel. It exists in St. Mary's County, Maryland, right at the juncture of the Potomac and the Chesapeake Bay. So this is the Potomac here, Chesapeake Bay, and it comes to a point where there used to be a little lighthouse, and then there was a huge hospital facility for sailors and Marines who would be serving on the blockading squadrons. But in August 1863, the Union prison system devises a massive stockade to hold about 5,000 Confederate prisoners. And by the end of the war, nearly 50,000 inmates would be incarcerated there. And this section right here is the stockade. It was a huge wooden barricade on the north side of the beach adjacent to the Chesapeake Bay. These positions here are the camps of the sentries. There's a main road that kind of led in. And you can see one of the reasons this region was chosen is because it's on a peninsula and it is nearly impossible to break out. There was a huge creek called Lookout Creek, which had two narrow causeways. And then there were forts at each of those causeways with artillery pieces that faced along them. So if there was a mass breakout, the leaders of that breakout would be blown to atoms by trying to cross into southern Maryland. Now, at first, the situation in this prison camp is fairly peachy. That is because there is a decent relationship between the Confederate inmates and their Union guards. These are some of the Union sentries at Point Lookout, the members of the New Hampshire Brigade. There were three veteran New Hampshire regiments sent to look out after these prisoners. And they treated the captives with respect. The prisoners were allowed outside the stockade at various points in the day to fish and to cut down lumber. They can grab crabs out of the bay. They can exercise. These are watercolor sketches done by a Confederate inmate, a guy named John J. Ammenhauser. That's a great resource that's kept up in the Maryland State Archives that kind of show Confederate prison life. And they're all very kind of humorous, kind of like little one-act cartoons. But the images show us what Confederate soldiers did. Here they are eating watermelons they've grown. Here they are grabbing blue crabs out of the bay. This poor fellow here's proboscis has been pinched because he didn't know what a crab was. And here they are fishing and bathing in the Chesapeake Bay. As a Union soldier who served as a guard described, he said, strict police and sanitary regulations were enforced. Good food and pure water amply supplied, and nothing for the health and comfort of the prisoners was wanting. They were all much better provided for than with their own army, and many of them better supplied than ever before in their lives. This treatment, so different from that of our own starving comrades in prison pens of the South, and so much better than expected by the rebels themselves, soon made its impression and had a favorable effect upon the recipients. Sectional prejudice and hatred, engendered and intensified by the war, soon softened into respect and even friendship, and a great change of vision came over the vision of their dreams. And how great a change was it? Well, you know, not all Confederates liked their guards. You know, they were guards. But nevertheless, about 1,000 or so Confederate prisoners took an oath of allegiance while they were incarcerated at Point Lookout. And what this means is they are now taking an oath of allegiance, binding themselves to the Union Army in exchange for freedom. And two regiments were formed from prisoners of war at Point Lookout, the 1st and 2nd U.S. Volunteers. This is, again, an amazing image inside the tent of the post-commandant, General James Barnes. These Confederate prisoners are now swearing on the Bible that they will fight and serve the Union and never the Confederacy. And these regiments, of course, they were not sent back into the Union Army, but they're actually sent out west to fight the Cheyenne and the Sioux because they didn't trust Confederate prisoners to hold to these oaths of allegiance. But nevertheless, this is the only prison camp where a massive amount of prisoners, or let's say massive, but a significant amount of prisoners actually decided to join the other side, to galvanize, as the term was known. It occurred at other prison camps too, north or south, but this is the largest one. So at first it appears as if the situation of Point Lookout is a model one, and it is for the first couple of months of operation, but then in November of 1863, things start to go sour. The first problem comes when these New Hampshire regiments receive new recruits. And many of these recruits are substitutes and bounty jumpers, those individuals who have taken money in order to join the Union Army. They're induced by a pecuniary interest, not so much an attachment to the cause. And what do these bounty jumpers most want in their Army service? What do you think they want to do?
Safety.
They want safety. They want out of the Union Army. And they find they have some brethren in the Confederate inmates because they want out of Point Lookout. So the bounty jumpers and the Confederate inmates start to conspire. The Union guards actually start giving them weapons and ammunition. They let them build boats. And there are all sorts of attempts at escaping Point Lookout. Of course, you're probably wondering, how in the world did they try to escape Point Lookout? Well, you had to swim for it, right? Because you have to basically build a boat on the Chesapeake side of the point, sail around the lighthouse, and then across the Potomac River. And the Potomac River is very wide at that point. But nevertheless, many Confederate inmates attempted it, and some succeeded. One of the most humorous incidents occurs where a Confederate inmate fakes his own death. You know, every day when they line up the dead at the dead house, you know, they just kind of pile them outside the stockade, and one Confederate soldier, while he was outside, he just put himself prone, remained still for the entire evening, and then grabbed a coffin and used the coffin as a boat to try to get it across the Potomac. Kind of like, what is that movie with the pirates? Pirates of the Caribbean, right? Part 2? Exactly like that one. Now, what worsened the situation between the inmates and the guards was when the New Hampshire soldiers left. They were replaced by the 36th U.S. Colored Infantry, a regiment of mostly North Carolina slaves. And this angered the Confederate inmates to no end. They could not stand the fact that black soldiers were now their guards. And these, again, are the images of the inmate Ammenhauser as he shows some of the incidents between these black sentries and their and the inmates. And you know, this one here shows the sentinel is asking this Confederate soldier where he's going or who he is. Like, and he says, "Well, I'm a friend." And he says, "Look here, white man, don't you say friend again. You're a rebel and a prisoner, and I'm put here to watch you. And how do you like that?" And so You know, African Americans who, again, felt that the Confederates were disrespecting their own rights as prisoners were now going to sort of enforce a very strict situation at Point Lookout. And if you ever read any accounts of Confederate prisoners, the thing that they are most angered about are facing these black guards, largely because the fact that the African-American troops understand the kind of revolutionary effect of the Civil War. And this is one of my favorite images of the entire era, again, drawn by Ammenhauser. What you see here is the stockade wall. And on top of the stockade wall, there was a platform. And this is where the sentries would patrol. They would just walk around the prison camp and look down into the camp area to make sure no hijinks was going on. And incidentally, if any of you are ever in that area, you should go to Point Lookout because a section of the stockade wall has been reconstructed, so you get a sense of what this prison camp looked like. But down in the floor here, next to the deadline, and this is the arbitrary dividing line between the wall and the prison camp, and if you stepped over it, the guard could immediately shoot you. This Confederate prisoner has approached the deadline, and this African-American soldier is taunting him. He says, "Get away from that there fence, white man, or I'll make Old Abe's gun smoke at you. I can hardly hold the ball back now. The bottom rail is on top." And just think about that phrase just for a second. The bottom rail is on top. If there is ever a piece of evidence from the Civil War to show its revolutionary nature, it is this. The African-American soldiers understand what this war has done. It has freed them and has placed them in command of their former masters. And so the Confederates are kind of shown that revolutionary change up front, and their insolence at their new guards is noticeable. They try to break from the prison far more often. There are far more fence line shootings as they approach the deadline than there were under the New Hampshire guards. So it seems that when you inject race into this question of the treatment of prisoners, atrocities tend to occur a lot more often. Now let's move to a different prisoner of war camp, one that housed Confederate prisoners in Chicago. This is Camp Douglas. Camp Douglas used to be a camp that was just for training soldiers, Union soldiers that mobilized. They would go into temporary encampment here before going off to the front. But after the capture of Confederate prisoners at Fort Donelson in February 1862, this camp now became sort of a permanent home to Confederate prisoners of war who either awaited exchange or by 1864 were there permanently. And again, not a pleasant place if you were a Confederate prisoner because of the conditions you had to endure. Many were kept in freezing cold conditions. And about 500 soldiers died within the first months of operation. One Confederate inmate described the sickening conditions of those who were slowly starving or dying of disease. He said, "In the latrine behind the barracks, I saw crowds of sick men who had fallen prostrate from weakness and given themselves wholly to despair. And while they crawled or wallowed in their filth, they cursed and blasphemed as often as they groaned. At the edge of the gaping ditches, there were many sick people who, unable to leave, rested there for hours and made their condition hopeless by breathing the stenchful atmosphere. Exhumed corpses could not have presented anything more hideous than dozens of these dead and alive men, oblivious to the weather, hung over the latrines, or lay extended upon the open sewer with only a few gasps intervening between them and death. Such as were not too far gone prayed for death, saying, 'Good God, let me die, let me go, O Lord.' And one insanely damned his vitals and his constitution because his agonies were so protracted. No self-respecting being could return from their vicinity without feeling bewildered by infinite suffering." This image here shows you the inside of Camp Douglas. You see the barracks that they lived in. They couldn't live outside, obviously, because the weather would be so cold. And you can see one precaution the Union guards have taken by elevating these buildings up off the ground to make sure that the Confederates weren't digging tunnels out. The situation was fairly bad. There was never any positive synergy between the inmates and the guards, largely because A lot of the guards tended to be wounded Union soldiers who were there on light duty. And, of course, they would take any opportunity to punish Confederate prisoners. Probably the most rigorous of the leaders at Camp Douglas was the Commandant Colonel Benjamin Sweet, who was wounded in 1862 at Perryville. And he had all sorts of infractions that he wished to punish. The Confederates could not spit tobacco. The barracks had to be kept spotless. And guards could shoot anyone they pleased. Even they could shoot into the barracks randomly if they heard a noise, because a noise would mean that they could suspect a tunneling attempt, and they could fire into it to keep the inmates quiet. Under Sweet's tenure, the guards could enforce individual punishments on people, some of which were humiliating and some of which nearly caused death. One of these punishments was known as riding Morgan's mule. It was a huge sawhorse that would be lifted about 8 feet off the ground, and the punished inmate would have to stand on the sawhorse or sit on it and kind of grip it tightly, and would be up there all day as the guards could watch him, and of course the sawhorse would do its unfortunate work on his inner thigh. Another was called reaching for grub, where a punished inmate would have to reach down and almost touch his toes and remain in that bent over position for several hours until either he suffered from a nosebleed or passed out. Now, one of the strange aspects of Camp Douglas was the fact that it was a camp where a lot of gawkers from Chicago would go to visit Confederate prisoners. And one of the things we talked about earlier in the class was the Copperhead Movement. And there were those Copperheads that actually expressed sympathy with the South. Well, in Chicago, there was a secret club of anti-war activists known as the Sons of Liberty. And the Sons of Liberty actually undertook a conspiracy in November 1864 to help release these Confederate prisoners, to find them a means of tunneling out of the facility. When word of this got out, there was an overreaction in part of Union commanders in Chicago. They arrested more than 100 people, accusing them of this conspiracy to release Confederate prisoners. And they also strip-searched many of the Confederate inmates in the snow. Now, there was indeed a conspiracy afoot. Some historians debate this. I believe there definitely was. All the historic evidence points to that fact. But many innocent prisoners died of exposure because of this effort to try to find any evidence that they were receiving intelligence from people outside. And I guess the last thing about this unfortunate prison camp was that it was very difficult to get good meat if you were a prisoner there, so the Confederates would resort to eating stray dogs. That was the thing that they were really good at, was attracting dogs to the stockade, grabbing them through, and then eating them. And they found they got extreme pleasure out of eating the prison guard dogs, if they could ever bring them over. And there was this one lieutenant that had a little dog, and the Confederates hated that dog. And they finally caught it, cooked it, and ate it. And the lieutenant, he was upset that he lost his pet, and he put a $10 reward for anyone who had information on it. Well, the very next day, the Confederates had graffitied the side of one of their barracks with a neat little poem that said, "For want of bread, the dog is dead. For want of meat, the dog is eat." All right, so let us turn to some prison camps in the South that were occupied by Union inmates. This is one that, if you've ever driven through Richmond, Virginia, you've probably passed close to. It is Belle Isle. And this started out as, again, a temporary prison camp, much like Camp Douglas, but it soon became a permanent place for Union prisoners of war, usually enlisted men. It housed about 10,000 prisoners, but it was simply an island in the James River, and it had a large ridge on it where the Confederate guards would be placed and have cannon pointing into the tents of these Union inmates. And a terrible place to be. An estimated 15 to 25 men died there per day in 1863. It was lice infested. The prisoners were allowed to bathe in the James River, which is a terrible prospect because the speedy current could sweep them away. And the guards were allowed to shoot any they believed were attempting to make an escape attempt. They would shoot them at the water line, and their bodies would be flushed down the river. This is yet another prison camp you would have found in Richmond. This is Libby Prison, designed for officers, a former tobacco warehouse. The second and third floor of this building was used to house prisoners, mostly officers taken at Gettysburg and Chickamauga. There was actually an escape attempt from this prison in early 1864 that threw the citizens of Richmond into a frenzy. And as a result, the commander of Libby Prison decided one of the things he needed to do was fill the basement with gunpowder. So in case there would be a mass breakout attempt of an even larger scale later on, the entire prison could be blown sky high, killing all the inmates with it. This image here gives you an idea of what it was like inside. Very dark, very dungeon-like, and rat-infested. In fact, the breakout attempt involved Union officers tunneling their way through a chimney down into the basement that they called Rat Hell because it was just a breeding ground for vermin, and they had to use Rat Hell, which was never occupied, as the means of tunneling out. And you know, more than 100 Union prisoners got out of it, but many of them were recaptured. Another prison camp we can profile here, and one even more upsetting than Libby, was Richland Jail in Columbia. And this was a prison camp reserved exclusively for officers of the two most hated of all Union regiments. Does anyone know what they were?
Jackson's.
Of Union regiments.
Would it be like USCT?
Right. So one of the things, this is where officers of the USCT go. All right. So that's one really kind of hated group of officers in the Union Army. Does anyone know what the other hated group? Border state officers. If you were a Union officer from Maryland or Kentucky or even occupied Tennessee, you were set aside from the others, drawn out to this prison camp, which is really just a building in the middle of Columbia, South Carolina, and that was where you would stay. Again, it was very poorly sanitized, filled with cockroaches, poor food, and cruel citizens who came by outside to mock the prisoners in their cells. One of the kind of shocking things for the Union officers who were kept there is that it was right across the street from City Hall. And every day they could see the city politicians out there eating fanciful meals out on the front lawn of the city building while they themselves were starving. One of those who was incarcerated there was a lieutenant named Freeman Bowley, and we've discussed this man earlier in class. He was the white Union officer who surrendered at the Battle of the Crater, was nearly lynched by the citizens of Petersburg when he was drawn in a parade through the city. Bowley described the conditions as follows. He said, "The cornmeal was sour, and much of it had ground cob and all. As a result of such food, much sickness resulted, and scurvy soon prevailed among us. I was one of the first attacked, and my flesh rapidly wasted away. My eyes were yellow, my skin dry and feverish, and sores broke out all over me. My feet were greatly swollen, my teeth loosened, and their gums would bleed upon the slightest pressure." And if you ever read Bowley's amazing account of prison life, you know, he describes how he nearly dies in this facility. This shows you one of the cells these officers would have stayed in. It would have been a room probably about half the size of the room we are in this morning. And I like to analyze pictures. And the best way, if you're a student of history, to analyze a picture is to read it like a book. You go top to bottom, all the way down, until you find something interesting. And I always find this little thing right here interesting, a bucket in the window. What is the bucket for? Right. That is for human waste. All right. So imagine these diuretic Union officers there, and there are about 30 of them, and again, in a room half this size. So imagine like if we all lived in this room half this size every day in the hottest part of the summer here in Norfolk, and you know, you were all suffering from bowel issues, and you had a bucket. All right, how do you empty the bucket? Throw it out the window. All right. That is exactly what you do. You can't go to the guard, right? Because the guard, you're going to give, I mean, as a Confederate guard, you're going to take the waste of Yankee officers. No, no, no. So one of you brave souls has to go to the window and dump it out into the street. What's the problem if you do that?
Get shot.
You're going to get shot, because that's where the sentries are. They guard the street, and if they see anyone looking at the window, they have the authority to shoot. So imagine going out that way. You're going out, dumping out the human waste. But it has to be done. So who's the brave soul that can't take the smell anymore? All right. One of our very last prison camps we will look at today is that of Andersonville, the most notorious of prison camps. It is established in February of 1864 when it opens for business. It's a wooden stockade kind of in south-central Georgia meant to hold 1,000 Union prisoners of war, all enlisted men. No officers were meant to be held here. But it held far more than that. During the summer of 1864, the prison population topped 26,000. Over twice its size. About 45,000 different inmates were quartered there during the 14 months of this prison's operation. It closed shortly before the end of the Civil War. And you can see Andersonville right at the end of its service. It was, I said, a wooden stockade wall that surrounded the encampment. This is the east side, west, then the north. And you can see a second stockade wall around it. This is to prevent tunneling out. But this stockade wall was not around for much of its history. It was kind of a late war addition. The same can be said of these barracks. These barracks were made for the sick, but they did not exist for much of its operation. These are the Confederate encampments, some Confederate forts to prevent the prisoners from escaping, because if they escaped, it was a severe health risk to the people of Georgia, as well as a roving army of starving men that would be going from farm to farm trying to look for food. The main Confederate encampment was over here near the rail line. And this here is probably one of the most important structures of the entire prison camp, and that is the natural stream that flowed under the stockade wall and into the camp. And it was downriver from the Confederate encampment. So the Confederates would use the headwaters of this branch, and it became known as the Stockade Branch, for their water supply and also for their animal waste and their own human waste, and it would flow into the prison camp and then settle right about here. And so essentially this was a cesspit right in the middle and Union prisoners on both sides. Here's some other images of the camp. Here you are looking west towards the train depot. And if you were a Union prisoner, say, taken during the Atlanta campaign or the Overland campaign, you would arrive here at this depot, be marched by your squad up to the gatehouse here. This is the main gate. This is known as South Gate. There were two big thoroughfares through the prison camp known as South Street and Broadway, named as such by the Union soldiers. And so you enter in through here, and you just basically entered into this big campground where these Union soldiers were kind of waiting out in the hot Georgia sun for the war to end. And this is the little area where the water flowed in, which brought in all the Confederate waste from this encampment here. And this is a close-up of one of the gates, the main gate. Now, the Union prisoners lived in little hovels that they created for themselves. They would try to scrounge together all the material they had, canvas for roof. They would try to cut down any trees in the area. And sometimes the Confederate guards would let them outside into the Georgia wilderness to bring in lumber so they could fortify their little homes, which they dug into the dirt. There's lots of digging of wells because the prisoners knew you couldn't drink the water from the stockade branch, because if you did, you would get a disease and perish quickly. So the only way you could get water was either by waiting for it to rain and soak it into your clothes and then wring it out, or you'd try to dig a well deep enough that you could actually extract water from the ground, which was a difficult thing to do because the Georgia clay was not conducive to good digging. And actually, some Union prisoners died digging wells. They were simply, the well collapsed and they were buried alive. And this sketch is from an inmate. This is a guy named William Knox Sneeden, a New York man who was captured in 1863 and spent much of his time in Andersonville. So he had has a nice set of watercolor sketches of the Civil War, many of them showing prison life. Now, Andersonville was commanded by a general named Winder, but Winder commanded the entire area. The man responsible for the Union prisoners and their daily rations was this man here, Captain Henry Wirtz, a Swiss immigrant who was viewed as kind of the tyrant of the camp. All of the Union soldiers if they wrote accounts after the war, derided this man for his cruelty. Part of his reason for being so strict with Union prisoners was his paranoia that they were tunneling their way out. He also attempted to punish the camp entirely for any minor infractions, whereas, you know, Commandant Sweet of Camp Douglas, he wanted to punish people individually. Wirtz, his challenge was to the entire camp to regulate itself, and if there was some infraction, the entire camp would bear the brunt of it, which meant, you know, half rations or a third rations for the rest of the week. Now, rationing was the most difficult challenge of these Union prisoners, because the way rations were issued is they were issued by a leading NCO, either a corporal or a sergeant, and they would be responsible for a group of 100 men. They were considered kind of the most responsible for each of these 100-man sections, and that person got the ration and they had to split it among everyone else. And again, try to imagine that if I gave you, let's say we gave Nicole a loaf of bread and she has to split it among 35 people, right? How are you going to split it?
Very carefully
indeed. Because if you come up short, who doesn't get the ration?
You do.
So this is kind of the prickly situation here. The person who is responsible for issuing these rations has the most power, and also the ones who stand to suffer the most, because if they issue these rations disproportionately, they're the ones that go without rations for that particular day. And incidentally, one of the things they also hated about Wirtz is that Wirtz had a series of wagons that would come in every morning, and they would pick up the dead, you know, because every day there was about a pile of about a dozen dead men, and they would be taken out and buried outside the prison. Well, the same wagon that took out the dead would also carry in their rations for the day, and it was just absolutely a disgusting prospect to eat off of this wagon that had once carried your friends out to the dead house. But nevertheless, you know, they were hungry enough that they would do it. All right, so one of the things that you had to be careful about if you were a Union prisoner was stepping too close to the deadline. Like Point Lookout, the stockade wall was surrounded by what were called pigeon roosts, these small little towers where there'd be one or two sentries monitoring the situation in the camp. In this artist rendition, you're looking south towards the south wall. Here's the stockade branch. And you can see these pigeon roosts. They mark the stockade every few feet. And the guards had the authority to open fire at anyone who stepped near the deadline. And if you wanted to commit suicide, if you wanted to get out, one way you could do it is just walk to the deadline and out you go. The one soldier from New York described one of the first of these shootings he saw. And he basically blamed the prison guards for being cruel. One of the things that he knew is that if a prison guard shot an inmate, they would get a furlough. And so there was kind of an incentive for taking down Union inmates. This New York soldier said, "I saw many men shot while I was there. I do not know their names. They were federal prisoners. The first man I saw shot was shortly after the deadline was established. I think it was in May. He was shot near the brook on the east side of the stockade. At the time, there was no railing. There was simply posts struck along where they were going to put the deadline, and this man, in crossing, simply stepped inside one of the posts, and the sentry shot him. He failed to kill him, but wounded him. I don't know his name. I also saw a man shot at the brook. He had just come in. He belonged to some regiment in Grant's army. I think it was about the first part of July or the latter part of June. He had just come in and knew nothing about the deadline. There was no railing across the brook, and nothing to show that there was any deadline there. He came into the stockade, and after he had been shown his place where he was to sleep, he went along the brook to get some water. It was very dark, and a number of men were there. He went above the rest so as to get better water. He went beyond the deadline, and two men fired at him, and both hit him. He was killed and fell right into the brook. I do not know the man's name. I saw other men shot. I do not know exactly how many. I saw several. It was a common occurrence." Now, social life was regulated by two gangs of Union prisoners in the stockade wall, the regulators and the raiders. The regulators were those that tried to enforce some sort of sense of law and order in the prison. They often protected those that had wells, because if you owned a well in the prison, you were basically a king among these inmates. And those that kind of own the well could find ways of getting stock in it by owning enough extra rations or enough extra lumber. Essentially, a capitalistic system emerged among these Union prisoners, with the regulators being the means of law enforcement. And the other gang was known as the Raiders. And this was a gang of people who were the strongest among the prisoners that would raid other mess mates and steal their provisions. And eventually the war between the regulators and regulators got so severe that the regulators went to the commandant, Captain Wirtz, asked him for batons, and he gave them batons, sent them in, and they regulated the system. They busted some heads, they captured a number of raiders, and they even tried them, and in mid-July hanged six of them for crimes against their fellow prisoners. And this inmate sketch by Sneeden is showing the six men hanging from a scaffold. And Wirtz was actually fine with the execution of prisoners by fellow prisoners. Here's an image of a photograph of the stockade. There are a few photographs of what Andersonville looked like. Here is the latrine in the stockade branch, and you're looking kind of north through the huge encampment. And this little section here is called the island. It was a big kind of swampy area. It's where the sickest of the Union soldiers lived, those that were too ill to even move out of the flooding waste area. Here's another image showing you the stockade wall in the background and the pigeon roosts. And this shows you an image of the overcrowding. And again, the prison camp was never expanded. It was just continually packed with more Union prisoners day by day. And the death rate skyrocketed. About 13,000 inmates died at Andersonville, or 29% of the population, or about 36 men per day. And to give you some comparison, the Battle of Gettysburg resulted in just about 10,000 dead, or 6% of those engaged. And it's probably unfair to compare the bloodiest battle of the Civil War to a prison camp, but if we put this in some perspective, you were more likely to survive Gettysburg, the bloodiest battle of the Civil War, than you were to survive Andersonville, because 29% of the inmates die at that, while only 6% of those at the Battle of Gettysburg die from combat. And then this is a very moving poem I saw about Andersonville, written by a captive. This is the text here, and here's our translation. Does anyone want to read this out loud? Any volunteers? Anne, go ahead.
There are hearts with hope still beating in our northern homes, waiting, watching for the footsteps that will never, never come. In southern prisons pining, meager, tattered, pale and gaunt, growing weaker, weaker daily. From pinching cold and want, here brothers, sons, and husbands, hopeless captives lie. O ye who yet can save them, will you leave them here to die? From out our prison gate, there is a graveyard near at hand, where lies 13,000 Union men beneath the Georgia sand. Scores on scores are laid beside them as day succeeds to day, and thus it ever will be till they all shall pass away, and the last can say when dying, with upturned and glazing eye, both love and faith are dead at home, and they have left us here to die.
Okay, so you get a sense of the pessimism and the fatalism that these Union prisoners experienced at Andersonville, that there was no way out now that the prisoner exchange system had broken down, and that a prison sentence was akin to a death sentence. This is an image of a survivor of Andersonville. He's a living individual, all skin and bones. Images like these were circulated about the North, and of course they raised the anger of citizens that the Confederacy would allow this to happen. And I'd like to read for you a few pieces of an enlisted man's diary. This is a Pennsylvania soldier named Samuel Elliott, who arrived in Andersonville in May 1864. He was one of those captured at the Battle of the Wilderness, and his account kind of describes several of the major incidents that occur in Andersonville, and you get this kind of sense that he thinks he is going to die very shortly. Sunday, May 22nd, arrived at Andersonville, 60 miles from Macon. The camp contains about 15,000 men, most of whom have been prisoners from about 8 to 10 months and were once strong, able-bodied men, but are now nothing more than walking skeletons, covered with filth and vermin, and can hardly be recognized as white men. The horrible sights are almost enough to make us give up in despair. The ground is covered with filth, and vermin can be seen crawling in the sand. In the center of the camp is a stream of dirty water, so warm and greasy we can scarcely drink it. The sights I saw on this, my first day in Andersonville, so filled me with horror that I can give but a poor idea of this prison den. Monday, May 23rd. 23 years old today. A miserable place to celebrate one's birthday. Wednesday, June 15th. A poor cripple shot for stepping inside the deadline. He said he was so miserable he wished to die, and he took this means of having his wish gratified. Thursday, June 16th. The small rations of such poor quality with the rainy weather is killing the men off at a terrible rate. There are now over 100 bodies at the gate to be carried to the dead house. Friday, July 2nd. The majority of the camp drew fresh meat from which the rebel quartermaster calls beef, but he can't fool the old soldiers with his mule and horse flesh. It might have been pretty good had it been brought in within a week after its death, or had been given us a large enough piece to allow for the maggots. We were too hungry to consider long enough about eating it, so drew chicken feed and a small piece of wormy pork. Quite a variety for one day. Went out for wood, the first time I've been outside the stockade since I arrived here. What a relief to see the outside world and get a breath of fresh air. Wednesday, August 3rd. On different battlefields, I have witnessed many horrible sights, but none compare with what I saw today, a man lying on the bank of the stream being eaten to death by maggots. They could be seen issuing from his eyes and mouth, and his body was eaten completely raw in several places. We could do nothing with him, but let him alone to die a miserable death. Sunday, September 4th. Attended at the funeral services of a member of Company F, who died during the night. It is terrible to see our regiment is thinning out. Every day brings the sad news of the death of one or more of our comrades. Death, nothing but death, throughout the prison. Rations small, almost starved. Now, one of the true heroes of the Civil War, for my mind, is Clara Barton, who arrived at Andersonville after it closed, and the prisoners were dispersed to other locations right before the end of the war. And she took pains to identify the dead. And you can see the evidence of her work if you go down to Andersonville today. The prison is just littered with rows of men. Most of them are identified. And this is just a small section of this big sea of anguish that you would have seen down there at the National Cemetery at that location. Now, the citizens of the North wanted vengeance for what happened at Andersonville. And Captain Wirtz, the commandant of the prisoners, was tried for war crimes in November of 1865. And in that month, they sentenced him to death. And without a doubt, Wirtz did not receive justice. A lot of the prisoners were stacked against him. Many of them had rehearsed their statements. And some of them probably weren't even prisoners from Andersonville, but had just read about it. In any case, he was found guilty. He was hanged just outside of the Capitol on November 10th, 1865. Union soldiers applauded the fact that he was punished to the fullest extent of the law for his command of Andersonville. Now, Wirtz's defense was that he could not have done any better than he did. They said that, listen, I did the best with the material that I had, and if you mean to criticize me, you have to go higher up the command chain to the generals in charge and perhaps to the Confederate War Department. And the Union people, after that conflict, listened to him. And they indeed considered, but did not execute, the possibility of trying Jefferson Davis for the crimes at Andersonville, because they said, ultimately, Davis is responsible for the deaths at that prison. Now, I'd like to sort of open it up here to some debate. Should Davis have been tried for war crimes? What do you think? Was Wirtz's final plea somewhat correct? Should Union prosecutors have gone higher up the command chain?
What's up?
kind of tricky because they're just, I think maybe that they, the union was just trying to put blame on somebody maybe, and then that was the person that the soldiers went to, the prisoners were like, that's the guy. And to go and try Jefferson Davis for a war crime is just a whole nother can of worms maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just they decided it wasn't, it was too difficult maybe, or didn't have enough evidence of it, you know, or something.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole host of reasons we'll talk about later in the course of why Davis is not tried. Because they have, there's many things they want to try him for, including just treason for leading the Confederacy. But one of the things they add to this list that they never bring charges against him is what happens to Union prisoners. And so do you think Davis is culpable?
I think yes and no, just because you also had the South getting cut off and having lack of food and everything else for one, their citizens, let alone soldiers, and the prisoners. Because their supplies are getting short by the end of the war, and it's very hard. And they're trying to also ration it out for everyone, because at the same time, they don't want their soldiers to die or their just their civilians to die, let alone they're trying to also keep the war crimes down and everything. But it's really hard because it's with the supplies that they had, they were doing the best they can, but at the same time, they could have done a little bit better of, like, the river in the middle of the camp and trying to keep that a little cleaner and direct it somewhere else. And so it's kind of a 50-50.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sticky problem. I mean, you can kind of see here where the northern public is coming from with this cartoon, because they're showing kind of the comparison of the Union prisoners at Andersonville compared to Davis's incarceration, which they say is fairly nice. It's kind of like a minimum security prison. And of course, it wasn't so nice because he was up in a casemate cell over at Fort Monroe, just across the water. But in any case, they said it was much better than what Union prisoners had received. Now, the one thing you say that doesn't quite satisfy me is this question of supply. Because you're saying that the Confederacy was suffering from a problem of keeping their own people supplied, much less the Union prisoners. Now, here's the reason that doesn't satisfy me, because if we go on that idea, that means that Confederate soldiers are dying at the exact same rate in their winter encampments. Are they dying at the exact same rate in their winter encampments? No. I mean, the atrocities on both sides, you can find them only in one side, in one area, the prison camps. That is where men are dying. And incidentally, does anyone know who are sort of the leaders of this effort to get Davis hanged for war crimes? And the prisoners are most certainly upset, but does anyone know who really leads the charge?
Abolitionists?
Ooh, a good guess. Good guess, Ryan, but actually not.
Maybe the sanitation people?
You mean like Clara Barton? And
yeah, or something like people all concerned about those terrible conditions.
Mm-hmm. There are many humanitarians that are concerned about what happens. But I say the real leaders of this charge are northern women, mothers. Listen to this shocking letter. I mean, absolutely shocking. You know, most historians say that, you know, women of the 19th century indulge in matters of the heart. And I want you to see if there are any matters of the heart in this letter. It is written to President Andrew Johnson, you know, the guy who takes over after Lincoln is assassinated. Dear sir, here's a picture of my dear son, Joshua Irving, Company G, 111th Illinois Volunteers, who was captured at Atlanta and taken to Andersonville. He went from there to the Carolina States and then starved and tortured to death. He died 10 days after he reached Baltimore from cruel treatment that the Rebs gave him, and he is the only one among 10,000 that Jeff Davis willfully put to death. Now, will you pardon him or give him his due? My dear Joshua was my last son, the staff of my old age, and now it is nothing more than justice that Jeff Davis' money should support those widows and mothers and orphans that he has made destitute by his wickedness. I view Lincoln as a second Moses and Jeff as a second Pharaoh, and you as a second Joshua. Now punish the rulers as they deserve. Feed them as they fed our sons and husbands. Give him a pint of cornmeal per day with the bran, as that is the way they fed my dear son, made him mush or gruel for 9 months, so he died in a few days after he was paroled at Baltimore, and I did not get to see him. Oh, I am heartbroken. When they were moving their prisoners from Andersonville, my son was sick with bleeding at the lungs from exposure. He begged to ride, but they swore that he should walk, and they would run a bayonet through him. He would have tried to have made his escape that night, but thought he was too weak to keep out of the way of the bloodhounds, so he suffered on for 9 months and had to dig a hole in the ground to protect him from the cold wind. Now, I do not know how he lived so long as he did, but God spared him to get him out of their hands. Now you may give my best wishes to Jeff, and that is this. I wish that it was in my power to deal out his punishment. I would just let him live as long as he could live in a cold, damp prison, eating corn mush with the bran. And if there was any meat left on his bones, the crows might have that. It might be that he would repent in that of his wickedness in that length of time. Your friend, Elizabeth Irvin. Imagine writing that to the President of the United States. All right, so to finish up, you know, we have here some statistics of prison camps, some select ones from the North and the South, showing you the mortality rate and the number of deaths. Some are better than others. Andersonville is definitely the number one worst, but closely followed by Elmira, which is a prison camp for Confederates in the North. So clearly, both sides had a poor record. And what explains this poor record? Is it negligence or is it mercilessness? What do you think? Stephanie.
Probably really didn't care that much about them. They were prisoners, like, they just really, they obviously, it shows they didn't care. They were feeding them old, weak old meat that probably had, like, salmonella in it, who knows.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, if they would have just took better care of them and thought more about it and actually showed a little more mercy, then maybe so many people wouldn't have died.
I think it could be also, like, you know, the whole theory in the 19th century of, like, battlefield, death on the battlefield was more courageous, and if you're a prisoner, it's kind of like a weak thing. So they kind of maybe saw that and didn't really see him as a full soldier because here they had to surrender, so now they're not really, you know, worthy of getting full rations as a fighting soldier or something like that because of that whole mentality of courage on the battlefield.
Yeah, possibility. It's difficult to say because starting off, we have, you know, a whole wave of respect. I mean, they're treated kindly, the New York soldiers had liquor, and then now they're starving. Paul.
Isn't it also with the Civil War, we had never seen POWs on a scale of like of this many. We never had a situation where we had this many prisoners all at once, so could it also just be because they didn't know how to handle this many people in their camps and that heavy of a prisoner population? They had to maintain their own soldiers and their prisoners as well, so they just didn't have the supplies for them all to feed them.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not really satisfied by this question of supply, but one of the things you do bring up here is that it seems like each of the phases that they create just sort of pushes the problem to the side, and they're just postponing this real question of dealing with large numbers of prisoners of war, such that by the end of it, they've sort of drifted into this horrible situation where you have men dying every day in prison camps. Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, like, I mean, obviously the different phases, it just showed that, like, where they came from as they got more numbers, you know, like, kind of like what you said just a second ago, but that, like, maybe, like, as they keep going and the problems just keep getting worse, the war is just lasting longer than anybody ever anticipated, and they probably just got tired of it, and those were the people who suffered. They just, let's shove them to the side. We're tired of fighting. We're tired of this. You tried to kill me last week, so like, just push them to the side and just keep going with it.
Right.
Getting tired of war.
Nicole.
Also, the soldiers that are guarding the camps, they also feel that this is the only way that they're helping their side win is by destroying these people who, if they're released, are going to go back and shoot at them again.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, it's not really a revenge thing. It's more this is their way of fighting the opposite side by not treating these prisoners well in order to kill them.
Right. And I mean, and certainly if we consider that explanation, that it's just sort of the animosity that comes out of the war that fuels, you know, things like the fence line shootings and the malnourishment, you know, it changes our perspective on what we think the Civil War was about. We've often called it the Brothers' War, And there's no sense of brotherhood between the two sides here. It's definitely a serious event, and one that was going to leave a lasting animosity between the two sides come Reconstruction. And so as we proceed on into that phase, as the war draws to an end, and they want to punish those who led the Confederacy, you know, these notions of Andersonville and Libby Prison and many others are going to be very firm in the memory of those who fought this conflict. It was not all glory. All right, we're definitely out of time. I'd like to thank our viewers out there on C-SPAN, and definitely thank you for an excellent lecture, guys. Enjoy the rest of your day.